Dave Andrew Radio Plays brings you The Whitechapel Murders File. This is an account of the horrible events of 1888, when a killer stalked the streets of London's East End, indiscriminately killing women and leaving a trail of terror in his wake. The Whitechapel Murders File recorded the deaths of 11 women, many of whom are regarded to be the victims of the infamous Jack the Ripper. The stories you are about to hear are real. The characters are real. The events are real. Take a step back in time and hear the stories these poor women never got to tell. The Whitechapel Murders File, Episode 6. Rose Milet, Alice McKenzie, The Pinching Street Torso, and Frances Coles.
Mary Jane Kelly was considered to be the final victim of the notorious Jack the Ripper, but there were several further entries added to the Whitechapel Murders File following her hideous killing. The next entry is for Catherine Rose Milet, who was found murdered 20th of December 1888. There was no mutilation involved, and early evidence seemed to point towards natural causes. It is only when a thorough examination was carried out that it was found to be anything but.
I'm Rose Milet, and I was born at 13 Thomas Street, Whitechapel, on 8th of December 1859 to Henry Milet and Margaret Haley. I had one brother whose name was William. I have no real recollection of my childhood years. They seem to pass by so very quickly. When I grew up, I met a man named Thomas Davis, and we started a relationship. Whilst we never married, we did have two children together, a daughter named Florence Davis and our son, Henry Davis. For a while, we were happy, but then, as is typical with life, the spark which had once drawn us together faded out, and the relationship ended. I found myself wandering the streets of Whitechapel looking for work and a place to rest my head. It fills me with shame to think about the things I had to do just so I could eat. When people fall so low, they lose all self-respect, and we do whatever we must in order to survive. On the 19th of December 1888, less than a week before Christmas, not that I had any real cause to celebrate it, of course, I met up with two sailors by Poplar High Street. They were all right at first, but one of them was becoming very demanding and aggressive, trying to make me do things I did not want to do. I remember losing my temper at one point and shouting, "No, no, no," at him. He had really annoyed me by that stage, and I just wanted to get away from the two of them. Whilst I was a heavy drinker, I was perfectly sober at that point and wanted nothing more to do with them. At about 2:30 the following morning, I was outside the George Pub on Commercial Road, chatting with a couple of men. I had been drinking heavily at that time and was quite drunk. I remember walking home past Clark's Yard when everything around me went dark, but I couldn't move. Fear and pain seemed to pass at once, and I fell into a deep sleep, one which I was never again to wake up from.
George Ptolemy had seen a woman whom he later identified at the mortuary as being Rose Milet in company with two sailors on the evening of the 19th of December 1888 when he was walking along England Row, now renamed Poplar High Street. His attention was drawn to the trio as something about them appeared to be out of place with him. He became instantly suspicious of the sailors, whom he describes as one being about 5 foot 5 inches tall, whilst the other was about 5 foot 7 inches tall. The taller of them was pacing up and down whilst the smaller one was speaking with Rose. He heard her saying, "No, no, no," to the man she was talking to, who then proceeded to speak to her in a lower tone. Ptolemy went on to say,
"He struck me that they were there for no good purpose, and that was why I took so much notice of their movements. I shall always remember their faces, and I could pick them out of 1,000.
He told the inquest that Rose had seemed perfectly sober when he had seen her. At about 2:30 a.m. on the 20th of December 1888,
A woman named Alice Graves saw Rose in company with two men outside the George Public House on Commercial Road. At this time, Rose appeared quite drunk.
Police Sergeant Robert Golding, in company with Police Sergeant Thomas Costello, found Rose dead in Clark's Yard at about 4:30 that morning. Her body was still warm, indicating that the death had only recently occurred. At that time, neither of them expected foul play. Indeed, the police commissioner, James Munro, was later to declare,
"The face was perfectly placid. The clothes were not disarranged, and round the neck was a handkerchief, loosely folded, but not tied. In the pocket of the dress was a small file, empty. In one of the ears was an earring, the other was missing. There were absolutely no signs whatever of any struggle, and no marks of violence visible. The police believed from the appearance of the body that the case was one of suicide or sudden death from natural causes."
Dr. George James Harris, the assistant divisional police surgeon, concurred with this statement. Following his cursory examination at the scene, he suggested that the body be removed to the mortuary, where the coroner's assistant, Curtin T. Chivers, examined Rose and came to a very different conclusion. There was a mark across her neck, which measured about an eighth of an inch deep, above which there were scratches, which were most likely caused by Rose trying to pull cord away from her neck. The divisional police surgeon, Dr. Matthew Brownfield, carried out a post-mortem, where he determined that the death had been caused by strangulation. There were thumb and index fingerprints on Rose's neck, which she would not have been able to cause herself. Dr. Brownfield concluded that the murderer would have been standing behind Rose and to her left, and that a four-thread cord would have been used to strangle her, the murderer crossing his hands over to achieve firmer leverage. Munro's response was to say,
"This evidence was certainly a matter of surprise to the police, but accepting the medical evidence as correct, the case was clearly one of murder."
He did, however, seek a second opinion from surgeon Mr. McKellar, who concurred with Brownfield. There was no mutilation to Rose's body. Therefore, it was not considered to be the work of Jack the Ripper, although the Star newspaper could not resist making a connection and printing their normal, sensationalistic headline to strike fear into the hearts of the community.
Rose Mylett is laid to rest at Tower Hamlets Cemetery.
"But I didn't do anything." "Remember me."
Alice McKenzie, formerly known as Alice Pitts, was born on the 8th of March, 1845, and murdered on the 17th of July, 1889.
It is thought that Alice was born in Peterborough to Charles and Martha Pitts, and was one of 10 children born to the couple. Some reports suggest that she married a man named Joseph Kinsey, with whom she had one son, Joseph James Kinsey. Kinsey died on the 18th of February, 1867, from tuberculosis.
From 1883, she is said to have met and formed a relationship with a man named John McCormack, also known as John Bryant, and lived with him on and off until her death. The couple were to share rooms in several lodging houses in the Whitechapel area, the final one being 52 Gun Street, Spitalfields.
She was quite well known in the area and had been given the nickname of Clay Pipe Alice, owing to the amount of tobacco she would smoke through her pipe.
On the night before her murder, she was seen talking to three women in Flower and Dean Street between 11:30 p.m. and midnight. Shortly afterwards, at 12:50 hours, her body was found in Castle Alley, just off Whitechapel High Street, by P.C. Walter Andrews. She was lying on the pavement, close to a street lamp. Her throat had been severed from left to right, and there was blood on her thigh and abdomen. George Baxter Phillips was sent for, and he pronounced life extinct at the scene. Whilst this was a very similar murder to those carried out by Jack the Ripper, for example the throat being cut from left to right, the extent of the injuries caused to her abdomen were not as brutally carried out, and were superficial in comparison. It was considered that a copycat murderer was now at large, although people at the time and in the modern day are still very much divided in opinion of whether or not this was the work of Jack the Ripper. Alice was laid to rest in Plaistow Cemetery on the 24th of July, 1889.
The torso of a woman was found under a railway arch in Pinchin Street, Whitechapel, at 5:15 a.m. on the morning of the 10th of September, 1889. Extensive bruising was found on the back, hip and arm, which suggested that the victim was severely beaten prior to being killed. It was also thought that the death had occurred shortly after the assault, probably the day before she was found. The abdomen had been extensively mutilated, much in the style of Jack the Ripper, although the genital area showed no signs of wounding. There was nothing found with the remains which could identify the victim, and no culprit was ever found or brought to justice. This murder forms part of the Whitechapel murders file, but it has been largely discounted by leading police officers at the time and by Ripperologists today as having anything to do with Jack the Ripper.
The last victim entered onto the Whitechapel murders file is Frances Coles. Hers was a very similar murder to those carried out by the Ripper in 1888, and speculation was rife that he had returned to wage his campaign of terror across Whitechapel.
I was born on the 17th of September 1859 at number 18 Crucifix Lane, Bermondsey, to William Coles, who was a bootmaker, and Mary Ann Carney. When I was still young, we moved to 8 Lion Court, which was also in Bermondsey, an area which had become known as the Leather District. In 1880, I'd left the family home and was working as a bottle stopper for a wholesale chemist. I hated the work. I remember moaning about it to my sister, telling her that it was very painful on the knuckles. I really couldn't take much more of it, so I left shortly afterwards. Jobs were not easy to come by. I did what I could, and then what I had to do to survive. I found it easier to cope with my lot if I drank, so I tended to drink quite a lot. I never let on to the family what I was doing. I couldn't have faced their looks of shame and shaking of their heads if they ever found out. Became easier to keep my secret as time went by. My sister, Mary Ann, invited me over for tea on Boxing Day 1890, and I was really grateful to her for doing so. When she asked me how I was earning a living, I told her that I was still working in the chemists and had found a place to live on Richard Street off the Commercial Road. I think she suspected that something was wrong. It was evident that I was very poor and my dress was looking really old and dirty. She also turned her nose up a couple of times when she smelled the alcohol on my breath. I tried to ignore it, but it still hurt, and I was so ashamed of myself for disappointing her. In 1891, Dad became an inmate of the Bermondsey Workhouse, which I hated. They were awful places, and I couldn't bear to think of my own father having to live in one. I made every effort to go to church with him on Sundays. It wasn't always easy, but I always did my best. I told him that I wasn't working at the chemist's anymore, but he never found out what I was doing to earn money. It would have killed me to see the shock and disgust on his face. I had a really nice surprise on the 11th of February 1891 when I went for a drink in the Princess Alice pub on Commercial Street. Former friend of mine, James Sadler, was in there, and we got talking about old times. We spent the evening and the night together going back to a common lodging house at 8 White's Row, Spitalfields. We stayed together the following day too, having drinks in several pubs and getting very merry. I went to buy a black crepe hat from a milliner called Peter Hawkes, who commented that I was three sheets to the wind. He wasn't wrong, but I was happy with it. That was about 7:30 in the evening. Good mood wasn't to last, though. I think the drunker we got, the more obnoxious we became, ending up rowing over money. I walked away, returning to the lodging house at about 11:30 and falling asleep on a bench in the kitchen. I heard that Sadler tried to get into the lodging house but was turned away by the night watchman, George Culver. Sadler was bloodied and bruised, telling Culver that he got into a fight and was mugged, claiming that I have been robbed and if I knew who'd done it, I would do for them. Culver helped him to wash up in the yard, after which he turned him away as he didn't have the money for a bed. He left at midnight and I was still sleeping in the kitchen. I woke up around 12:30 and realised that I didn't have any money to pay for a bed, so I left the house and went out into the night. I was very hungry, so I went to Shuttleworth's eating house on Wentworth Street, where I bought 3 halfpennies worth of mutton and some bread, and sat at a corner table to eat it. This was about 1:30 in the morning. I still sat there after I'd finished and was asked by the man who worked there, Joseph Aswell, if I could leave. I ignored him at first, but he went on to ask me twice more, so I told him to mind your own business and sat there a little longer. I left Shuttleworth's at about 1:45 and headed off towards Brick Lane. There was always something happening there, and I may meet somebody who would give me enough money for my bed. I was walking along Commercial Street when I saw a friend of mine, Ellen Callaner, and stopped to talk to her. A violent man in a cheese-cutter hat came along and started talking with Ellen, asking her if she wanted trade. And when she said no, he punched her in the face, causing her to have a black eye. And when he turned his attentions to me, I said yes. I didn't want to be punched as Ellen had been. So I asked her if she was all right before bidding her good night and walking off with this man, much to Ellen's alarm. We were walking through Swallow Gardens railway arch at 2 a.m. when we saw three men walking towards us. They were jovial enough, and I wish that I'd stopped to talk with them now. They may have been able to get me away from this frightening man. They shouted hello, but we just kept on walking and never replied. It would have been so much better for me had I gone with my first instinct and stopped to talk with them, as only moments later I felt a crushing blow and then everything fell silent.
The three men who Francis Coles had seen were William Friday, a carman, who was affectionately known as Jumbo, and the Napton brothers. They said the man looked like a ship's fireman, but no further description was forthcoming. One of the brothers had shouted, "Hello!" but they were ignored. At 2:15 a.m, PC Ernest Thompson, shoulder number 240H, was commencing his first ever solo patrol, walking a beat which was to take him along Chamber Street, only a few minutes from the Leman Street police station. He had been in the force for less than 2 months at this time, and this was the first time he had been trusted to patrol without supervision. He became aware of running footsteps in the distance making off in the direction of Mansell Street, so he headed in that direction, where, only a few moments later, he found the body of Francis Coles, lying in a dark corner of Swallow Gardens. From the arc of his lamp, he could see blood flowing from her throat. And as he looked at her, he noticed her open and close one eye. As there was a presumption of life, he could not give chase to the suspect making off. Police procedure dictated that he remain with her to do all he could to save her life. At 2:25 a.m, he was joined by PC Frederick Hyde, shoulder number 161H, followed later by Superintendent Thomas Arnold, Inspector Edmund Reed, and a local doctor named Dr. Frederick Oxley. Wounds were found on the back of Frances' head, concurrent with a heavy fall, and her throat had been slashed 3 times from left to right to left, and left to right once more. It is thought that the knife used had a blunt edge.
There was no mutilation to any other part of Francis's body, and it is thought that the murderer may have been disturbed by PC Thompson when he was on foot patrol in the area. It was said of PC Thompson that his inability to follow the killer, who may well have been Jack the Ripper, would haunt him for the rest of his days, which, very sadly, were not long in coming. And he was stabbed to death in 1900 by a man named Barnett Abrahams in a brawl at a coffee house.
James Sadler was later arrested and charged with her murder, although he was subsequently released from custody on the 3rd of March 1891.
Following their argument and his subsequent eviction from 8 White's Row, he got into at least two further fights that night and was covered in blood. He returned to White's Row at 3 a.m, but was once again asked to leave by the deputy housekeeper, Sarah Fleming, causing Sadler to tell her,
"You are a very hard-hearted woman. I've been robbed of my money, of my tackle, and half a chain."
Fleming noted that he was so drunk at the time that he could barely stand up. At 5 a.m, Sadler admitted himself to the London hospital to have his wounds treated. What adds a little more credence to his involvement is the allegation made by Duncan Campbell, a seaman who lived at the sailor's home in Wells Street. Apparently, Sadler sold him a knife for the price of a shilling of tobacco, and went on to testify that the knife was so blunt that he needed to sharpen it to cut his food.
What goes against Sadler being Francis Cole's murderer is the fact that he was exceedingly drunk and had been seen by Police Sergeant Edwards at 2 a.m. looking decidedly drunk outside the Mint. At that time, the Royal Mint was located in the Tower of London, which was not far away from Swallow Gardens, so geographically it could fit that Sadler was responsible. Like with all of the murders which precede this one, we will never know for sure, although Sadler was acquitted through lack of evidence.
I don't understand. Why?
Whoever it was who cruelly ended the life of Frances Coles, she was laid to rest on the 25th of February 1891 at East London Cemetery, Plaistow.
Remember me.
Speculation has always been rife as to the identity of Jack the Ripper, which was in fact a handle he was given by unscrupulous journalists who were behind the infamous Dear Boss letter, which was sent to the Central News Agency. Some of the grander theories even had a royal connection, such as Dr. William Gull, the Queen's physician, or, even grander still, her own grandson, Prince Albert Victor, Duke of Clarence. Initially, the murderer was known as Leather Apron, as one was found in the yard of 29 Hanbury Street following the slaughter of Annie Chapman. The apron actually belonged to one of the residents, John Richardson, and was in the yard drying out after his mother had washed it. Unfortunately, the overzealous press ran with the story that the killer had left his apron behind, which led to the persecution of anybody who used one to earn their living, the most well-known being a local Jewish bootmaker by the name of John Pizer, who was hounded by a police sergeant by the name of William Thick, who would single him out for arrest at any given opportunity. The Dear Boss letter was sent to the Central News Agency on the 25th of September 1888, and this was the first time that the name Jack the Ripper was used. "Dear Boss, I'll keep hearing the police have caught me, but they won't fix me just yet. I've laughed when they look so clever and talk about being on the right track. The joke about Leather Apron gave me real fits. I am down on whores and I shan't quit ripping them till I get buckled. Grand work the last job was. I gave the lady no time to squeal. How can they catch me now? I love my work and want to start again. You will soon hear of me and my funny little games.
I saved some of the proper red stuff in a ginger beer bottle over the last job to write with, but it went thick like glue and I can't use it. Red ink is fit enough, I hope. The next job I do, I shall clip the lady's ears off and send them to the police officers just for jolly. Wouldn't you? Keep this letter back till I do a bit more work, then give it out straight. My knife is so nice and sharp. I want to get to work right away if I get the chance. Good luck. Yours truly, Jack the Ripper. Don't mind me giving the trade name. P.S. Wasn't good enough to post this before I've got all the red ink off my hands. Curse it. No luck yet. They say I'm a doctor now. Following the double event, the Saucy Jack postcard was sent to the Central News Agency, which they received on October the 1st, 1888. I was not codding, dear old boss, when I gave the tip. You'll hear all about Saucy Jackie's work tomorrow. Double event this time. Number one squealed a bit, couldn't finish straight off. Had not time to get ears for police. Thanks for keeping this letter back till I get to work again. Jack the Ripper. On 16th of November 1888, George Lusk, the chairman of the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee, received the From Hell letter, which was accompanied by a small parcel containing part of a human kidney. The tone of the letter was very different from the others, as the spelling was very poor quality, Sir being spelt S-O-R and the Y being left off of the end of kidney. This was possibly a ploy to add further confusion to the investigation.
So, I send you half the kidney I took from one woman, preserved it for you. T'other piece I fried and ate. It was very nice. I may send you the bloody knife that took it out if you only wait a while longer. Signed, Catch Me When You Can, Mr. Lusk.
It seems almost inconceivable that two police forces, plus the Whitechapel Vigilance Committee, could be patrolling the streets of Whitechapel, and yet this man continued to kill undetected. We may moan about the intrusive nature of CCTV, but what a difference that would have made back in 1888. How many lives would have been spared because of it?
Our journey through the streets of Victorian London is now at an end. This has been a labour of love for me, one which I could not have completed without the help, support and encouragement of my family, friends and loved ones, many of whom have been kind enough to lend me both their time and their voices in completing this project. In many cases, this is the first time that these wonderful people have ever done anything like this. I'm so very proud of them all. And they should be very proud of themselves too. My gratitude to them is immeasurable and can never adequately be expressed. The music, which was used in episode 6, has been provided courtesy of YouTube and includes the title music, which was created and performed by the Power Music Factory, Hymn of the Cherubim by Tchaikovsky, Moonlight Sonata by Beethoven, and Nocturne Opus 9 No. 2 by Frédéric Chopin. Rose Milet was played by Sharon Preston, Frances Coles was played by Caroline Tattersall, and narration was by Sarah Robinson, Daniel O'Rourty, and Dave Andrew. This production was devised and produced by Dave Andrew, using historic documents and reports from the time, along with information gleaned